Today's program has been brought to you by the International Culinary Center, offering courses that range from classic French techniques in culinary, pastry, and bread baking to Italian studies to management, from culinary technology to food writing, from cake making to wine tasting. For more information, visit internationalculinarycenter.com.
Broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to heritageradionetwork.org.
Hello and welcome to Cooking Issues. This is Dave Arnold, your host of Cooking Issues, coming to you live every Tuesday from roughly 12:45 here on the Heritage Radio Network in the back of Roberta's Pizzeria in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Joined with Joe and Jack in the engineering room, Nastasha the Hammer Lopez, as always, sitting next to me. How you doing, guys?
Good.
Yeah, everyone good? Good. So I'm glad I got to do today's show, because right after we have our weekly Roberta's Lunch, which Nastasha and I always enjoy, thanks to the radio station. They give us the free lunch. That's what we work for here, people, by the way. In case you were wondering what the reward for the show is, it's the free lunch. After that, I'm going to the airport and going to Colombia, my favorite South American country. Of course, it's the only South American country I've gone to, but it is...
Panama. That's central.
Well, yeah, the Panamanians think Panama is South America, whereas because it's part of the skinny part, which I consider to be Central America, I call it Central American, but that kind of pisses them off because they consider themselves South American. I was like, if it's not Central America, then why do we, you know, why is the canal there? Because it's the skinny part. In fact, it's the skinniest part. Right or wrong?
Right.
Yeah? Yeah. Anyway. So, Panama being my favorite Central American country I've ever visited. And Colombia being my favorite South America. But I actually, not just the only, I do actually like Colombia quite a bit. Going to Bogota. And the great news is, I'm going to look up your Lucuma stuff, by the way. Even though they don't have it there, they have a close relatives I can play with. And I get to visit a coffee plantation in Armenia, which is in, you know, the heart of Colombian coffee growing thing. So I'm going to hopefully, if it's there right now, pick some coffee, do some fun stuff, and report back next week with news of coffee. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? Yeah. Okay. Call in your questions to 718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128. Got some questions from last week that I didn't do. This one in from Senor Trepaz. I answered his question last week about Carpano Vermouth, but don't believe I answered his question about cherries. I'm interested in making shelf-stable maraschino or bourbon-style or maraschino or bourbon-style cherries. All the recipes I found call refrigerated storage for a period of weeks. I want to keep them at cellar temperatures for up to a year. Okay, well, look, so the actual things that you buy in the store as maraschino cherries, what they do with those things is they bleach the color and flavor out of them and make them stable in a solution of kind of like sulfur dioxide, which is a bleacher and a preservative and an antifungal, I think, and calcium chloride. Calcium chloride is what gives maraschino cherries that hardness, right? Because what the calcium is doing, calcium chloride is actually horrible because it tastes bad, but calcium chloride, what it does is the calcium helps to cross-link the pectin inside of the cherry and cause the flesh of the cherry to not break down over time, right? So that's why the calcium is there. Then they put it in food coloring and syrup over a length of time to reinfuse it with sugar, because it doesn't really have any much sugar left or flavor or anything like that. And that's not the way to do it. That's horse hockey. Toby Cicchini, the bartender famous for the Cosmo, I think I did mention him last week in regard to cherries, but I gave a very abbreviated cherry. If I talked about cherries at all, it was super abbreviated, and I apologize. So he makes his own, but I don't have his recipe. I wasn't able to get in touch with him and get his recipe. But you want to look up – the person to look up on this on the internets is Darcy O'Neill from The Art of the Drink, who also did Fix the Pumps, the incredibly influential book on kind of bringing back stuff from the soda fountain days, from the soda jerk days. And so, okay, so I'm going to compile all of these things. First of all, some of the patents online and maraschino cherries in the store are made with sweet cherries. Old style real cherry, like cocktail cherries, are brandied sour cherries, and at least that's what I'm told. And Toby tells me that he's tested sweet cherries and sour cherries, i.e., or sour and or bitter cherries, like you know Morellos and all those things, and says that the sweet ones are horrible and insipid, and the sour ones are the ones you want. And that's actually borne out if you get the Italian preserved cherries. They're the smaller kind, like, you know, the ones that we get in the blue ceramic jar, whose name escapes me. But they're smaller and, not the sweet style. Now, if you want a good free guide to old cherry varieties, i.e. cherry varieties prior to about 1920, look up Cherries of New York. You can get a PDF version online for free. It's like from the teens or 20s, and it's got full color pictures of all the cherry varieties that were grown in New York at that time, which is also a wide range of all the cherry varieties that existed. Not all of them by a long shot, but ones that are available here in New York from the Geneva Agricultural Experiment Station. And I actually have the whole collection in hard copy. Now listen, here's what I'm going to say. I'm violently allergic to cherries. I can't eat them. Haven't been able to eat them since I was 30 or 31. So bear that in mind. Don't, like, you know, like anything here, I can't actually test it for you because it'll kill me. Okay. Now, the trick there's two tricks. One, you want to keep the cherries firm, and two, you want to gradually preserve the cherries so that they don't rot. So typically, there's two things we add to cherries to preserve them: sugar, to increase the sugar content so that we're storing them high sugar so that they don't go bad, and two, we're adding an acid, which is an antifungal in the thing. It's basically a preserved antibacterial antifungal thing in the syrup. And three, you're going to add sugar, alcohol, whatever. I forget. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, whatever. Like sugar, alcohol, acid, and calcium you're going to add to this. But you have to do it carefully because you have to preserve the osmotic balance of the cherry so that they don't shrivel and or rupture. And I'm going to come back and give you what the answers to that is, but I have a caller on the air. Caller, you're on the air.
Hey, Dave. Big fan. I got a question for you today about shellfish protein. Trying to make Todman, sort of fish paste, a little bit of egg, some curry, fried, delicious Thai street food, and was thinking of trying it with shrimp paste. In fact, was thinking of frying it around some sugar cane. Problem is, when you grind up shrimp paste, toss in a little egg, it falls apart when you throw it in oil. And was curious, you know, I realized, oh, maybe that's why crab cakes are much harder to keep together than burgers, but I was hoping you could shed a little light on what's going on and if there's a relatively simple fix.
Huh. Well, I wouldn't have expected that. But, I mean, obviously, the easiest fix, I mean, aside from actually figuring out what's going on in the recipe formulation, is just to add a little bit of transglutaminase to it, like Activa RM, and it would bind it, you know, lickety-split. Is there enough salt in there for the proteins to bind together?
Yeah. There's I add a pinch of salt to everything. Didn't add a crazy amount, and shrimp has some natural salt in it, does it not?
Yeah, should. And you process it long enough for it to get what looked like a good bind in the mix before you fried it?
Yeah.
That's very odd. But I know for a fact that shrimp with a little bit of transglutaminase added to it, if you'd have to poach it probably first in a little water stock to set the outside, but they won't break ever. Never. They will not break. I mean, that's what Wiley, you know, does to make his shrimp noodles. And those things, I've fried them, and they fry fine. So I'm assuming that egg, also containing protein, wouldn't interfere with the bind with the I'm just so surprised. Although, when you think about it, like, I always, when I'm doing things, I never do straight shrimp, like in my sausages and poaching mixtures for, like, fish quenelles. It's always fish, scallops, and shrimp. So maybe there is something strange about shrimp. But, I mean, do you have access? I mean, you can, for Modernist Pantry, you can buy a fairly small amount of transglutaminase, and it's fairly easy to use. Just sprinkle a little bit in. The maximum you can add is 1% by weight, but you don't need nearly 1% by weight just to keep it together. In fact, that might make it too firm.
All right. I'll try it, I'm curious though. You know, why do crab cakes fall apart more easily than a burger or something like that? Is there something about seafood proteins that make them bind less than meat?
Yeah, well, crab cakes. Remember, a crab cake is being formed from meat, at least when I make them, that's already been cooked once. So there's not a lot of the protein's already coagulated in it, and so and especially kind of the lump style crab meat that you're using, the bigger bigger chunks aren't going to want to bind together. So you know, in a native uncooked protein, it hasn't been coagulated yet. You know, there's a lot of soluble, you know, liquid bound proteins. You add salt, more of those things come out, and they kind of form a gluey, sticky matrix. And then when the heat sets into kind of a solid matrix, like a sausage. That's how it works. But whereas something like crab meat, you know, it's already been set, so you can't do it. I don't
make sense.
Yeah, I mean, again, you can take crab meat and bind it with transglutaminase and get it to stick together, or you could add some uncooked protein like fish protein to it to help bind it if you don't want to add other extenders. But the crab meat itself is never going to bind together as well just because it's cooked.
Thanks, Rhea. I'll try it out.
Let you know.
Thanks.
Okay, cool. Thanks. Bye. All right. So back to the cherries for a second. So here's what you want to do. If you go to Darcy O'Neill's website, The Art of the Drink, which I, first of all, highly recommend that you do, you should go to his website. I don't know. Buy his, you know, acid phosphate soda. Support the man. You know, he's doing very good work for all of us in the world of cocktail and technologies. And he's an actual scientist. I don't know if he still does science for a living or whether he just does cocktail stuff for a living. Anyways, what you want to do is figure out about how much sugar is in your cherry. And I don't know that I trust his numbers 100% because I've read other numbers, but he's basically saying that the equivalent bricks, which is weight of sugar in water for a cherry, is somewhere on the order of 5 or 6 to 16 bricks. I've heard as much up to like up to 22 bricks percent sugar on one of the sweeter cherries. So you're going to want to start with a sugar syrup only slightly more sugary than that. So 1-to-1 simple syrup is going to be too much to start with. Start lower and work your way up. Add acid, and Darcy says that malic and citric are the two components that are mainly the acids in there, so you're going to want to add probably more malic than citric, although that's also what kind of limes taste like. So you're going to want to add malic and citric acid. You're going to want to add sugar, right? And then you gradually increase the sugar content of the syrup. Now, he says to make sure there's enough syrup in there such that the sugar content doesn't decrease too much because of the water that goes in. But I would say go a little bit stronger, add a little bit as you go, get a strong syrup. And then after it's preserved in syrup, start doping in alcohol, like super high-proof ethanol, until it gets to where you want it. And then you should be good for a year. But please go read Darcy O'Neill's posts on preserved cherries. Now, we have a caller. Oh, anyway, caller, you're on the air.
Hey, Dave. I just made about 20 pounds of homemade sausage.
Nice.
And yeah, and I cooked it the way I usually cook sausage, and I did like a link of each batch I made. I did like 4 different ones, and they all turned out really mealy. And I did a little research, and it says it's just from the fat breaking, from making it too hot.
Right.
And I'm wondering why you know, I can do it in a lower temp next time, but I'm wondering why normal sausages don't break like that, because the way I normally cook it is you know, I'll brown it on one side in a pan and then flip it and put a little water in the pan and cover it. And then after about 10 minutes, I take it off and then cook it until it's kind of brown a little more.
Yeah, no, what they're talking about with high temperature isn't on the cook side. They're talking about high temperature on the make side.
Oh, okay.
So, like, typically, what kind of sausage was it again?
Well, I did some Thai chicken with some ground up chicken thighs and a little fat back in there, and then put Thai chilies and Thai basil. I did a turkey with dried cherries. A lot of stuff all out of the charcuterie book.
Right. So yeah, but so not emulsified though. Regular sausage mixers, not like made into a batter emulsified. Right. I mean, fat.
Right.
Right. Okay. Yeah. I think. Are you par freezing the meat and the fat before you grind it?
I try to. I don't have a great grinder though, and so it was kind of just making more of a paste than actual stuff. But half of the sausages I made, I just bought from our local butcher shop. They make their own sausages, and they sold me a pre-ground blend of, you know, pork belly or pork shoulder and pork fat to, you know, like 35% fat. And they just sold it to me pre-ground, so I wouldn't think that would break as well.
Huh? And that one's the one that went mealy, the one that they did pre-ground for you.
All of them did. The ones I ground myself and the ones that they had pre-ground.
I mean, that's the cooking technique that you talk about, the old school one, pre-poach and then brown off, right? That's what you said you do. That's
right.
That's what I typically do if I don't have a circulator. I mean, that's good technique. So that's not doing it. So it's got to be, I mean, typically when you're looking at sausage manufacture, there's, you know, the main things are, do you have a high enough fat content, which you do, you asked, you got it, right? Do you have a high enough salt content to get a good bind going? Because that'll also mean it won't bind together well if you don't have a high enough salt content, because the salt is what's allowing the proteins to kind of come out and form that bind in a sausage mix, right? So was it bound right? If it's not bound right, it's going to be more like, you know, compressed hamburger meat, right? Three, was the temperature of the fat and whatnot cold enough when it was ground, so you're not getting weird smearing effects, and then you'll get a lot of, you know, if the fat tissue is disrupted and melted instead of, you know, ground cleanly, then you'll bleed the fat out and you'll be left with dry and mealiness. So the temperature of the meat is important, and you know, proper trim is important when you grind it. And thirdly, the temperature is vitally important in emulsified sausages, because you're making an emulsion, and the emulsion will break if it gets too hot. And really, those are the main factors that I always, I mean, not that I'm a huge expert in it, but those are the main factors that I always look for in troubleshooting a sausage problem to see what's gone wrong. But from what you've told me, I can't really figure out which one of those kind of like main precepts of sausage making were violated, especially because you say you've done it before without problem, right?
Yeah, and I mean, when I cook regular commercial sausage, they never break the way I cook them. So I was wondering if they added something to it and, you know, to keep it from doing that, or if it's just that I messed up somehow this time.
I mean, you can add things to sausage to keep them from breaking, but you shouldn't have to. Do you know what I mean? So,
right,
like, anything that you add to a commercial sausage, anything that's added to things to stabilize them are there to, just in case somebody happens to abuse them, like carrageenan or things like that. But they shouldn't ever be necessary to produce a good sausage. I mean, the only things necessary are high fat content, proper temperature regulation during manufacture, and proper salt content. And, of course, proper fat type. If you add a fat that's been rendered, that's going to be horrible. If the fat's already been rendered once, you know, it's never going to come back to its native form, and then the fat won't hold in properly. All the fat will bleed out, and it's going to be a huge nightmare, you know? I mean, like yeah. you were using fat back.
Yeah, if I got fat back from the local butcher shop and chopped it up and put it in the freezer. But I was using a new, it's actually a vintage grinder I got from my dad. It's just a rival sausage grinder. But it seemed like it was really maybe grinding it too much, where the fat wasn't coming out in little chunks more than when it was coming out in almost a paste. So I'm thinking I might have ground the fat too much.
Yeah, if the fat was, like, came out like a, I mean, it's hard to know, like, if it comes out as a paste and you're breaking it up too much, then perhaps you would need to treat it then more like an emulsified sausage. If that breaks and that weeps out, right, then it's not going to. So, you know, anytime you have fat isn't, you know, obviously fat's not just fat. Fat is mixture of fat and connective tissue and a bunch of other things. And so when it's native, it'll hold itself kind of in place properly. And when it's been melted out, then it's never going to hold itself right, which is why they don't want the fat to get smeared when they're grinding for sausage. But maybe the blade isn't sharp on the grinder. You might want to sharpen the blade and look at it, just making sure you're getting good contact. It should grind clearly and shouldn't come out warm at all or like a paste. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think that's the problem. It's something from back in the 70s, and it probably hasn't been sharpened for 30 years. So
right, I mean, those should work. Like the old Porkert style or Rival, they're all the same. They look like the KitchenAid, but the barrel, it looks like it's been pulled out in Photoshop, right? One of those guys?
Yeah.
And they're like, they're like shiny tin plate cast iron, those guys. They should work. It's just maybe the blade wasn't sharp. You should also put the grinder in the freezer as well, so the grinder's cold.
Okay.
But it sounds like maybe that's what happened, is that you maybe something went wrong with the fat back, and it just didn't grind right, paste it out, and then leaked on you when you cooked it.
So there's no salvaging it. I took some leftover and made burger type, an uncased, and fried them up, and those seem to taste all right.
Yeah, I'm sure they would.
Stuff out of the casing.
Yeah, you could do that, or the real problem is that if you had super accurate temperature control, you might be able to cook them at like a straight, like a 140, and then do a quick sear off on the outside without melting it out too much. But I don't know. I'd have to see because I don't really know. At those temperatures, some of the pig fat will remain semi, not super liquid. I mean, it'll all liquefy, but not like super liquid, and you might get it to not kind of run everywhere and go crazy. But I think maybe breaking it up might be. Breaking it up and making patties out of it might be the way to go.
All right, Dave. Thanks for the help, buddy.
Hey, thanks. And let me know next time you try it whether fixing that solved it.
All right, cool. Take it easy.
You too. All right, so listen, Jack, why don't we go to or Joe, I don't know who's there right now. Why don't we go to our first commercial break with Cooking Issues?
International Culinary Center is a proud sponsor of the HeritageRadioNetwork.org. The ICC, with locations in New York and California, provide cutting-edge education to future chefs, restaurateurs, and wine professionals. We're proud to claim Dan Barber, Bobby Flay, and David Chang among our honored alumni. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton from Chef Story. Check out our ICC website at internationalculinarycenter.com.
Hello. And so that, the band, Jack tells me, that is fellow radio show host Damon Bolte's band called Brothers, because Damon Bolte has a twin brother who apparently is also in the band. Although it'd be funny is if he had a band called Brothers and his twin brother wasn't in the band. That'd be more funny, I think. I think maybe he should do that. They should have some sort of rift. But you should definitely go check them out and see them if you're really into seeing 9 feet tall, skinny bartenders play music, right?
Yeah.
He is kind of really tall man.
Yeah.
He's like as tall as Tristan.
Yeah.
He's a tall man. Mm-hmm. How tall would you say Damon is?
He's taller than me. I mean, he's got to be a good 6'3".
Yeah, yeah. How does he fit into the chairs here in the studio?
He does.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He's never been on my show.
He should be.
I've never been on his show. You know why? He hates me.
No, he doesn't.
I know he doesn't hate me at all. I'm just kidding. He's a good man. Damon.
Who I said, or who I was talking to, who said that they would like to be on the show is Tosi.
Yes, he Tosi?
Yeah, wouldn't that be cool?
I would love that.
Wow.
Yeah, we'll do that. And back to Damon for a second. Do you know he makes an excellent old-fashioned? Were you aware of that fact?
No. Well, I assumed as much, but...
Excellent
old-fashioned. What's so special fashion about
his old-fashioned? They're very delicious. He made... what was the old-fashioned he made for us at the museum event?
Ooh, I don't remember.
But it was damn good.
Yeah.
It was like... He doesn't talk like this. He's like, I'm going to do something really simple. Someone's going to make an old-fashioned. It's going to be delicious. Crap on you guys. He doesn't talk at all like that. He's not like that. But listen, speaking of old-fashions and cocktails and food...
Yeah.
You need to come to HeritageRadioNetwork.org's members-only party September 9th between 5 and 8 p.m. at Roberta's Pizza, 261 Moore Street in Brooklyn, New York. There will be food from Gramercy Tavern, Back 40 West, Del Posto, Momo Sushi, Inside Park, Parish Hall, Heritage Foods USA, catered by Roberta's, Seat a Table, Saxelby Cheesemongers, and Heritage Meat Stop. Cocktails by none other than me, Dave Arnold! El Buco Mezcal, Galliano, Absolute Vodka, Plymouth Gin, and Pierre Jouet Champagne. Beer by GreatBrewers.com, Greenport Harbor Brewing, and Cane Vineyard and Winery. Buy your tickets for $150. What does a VIP ticket get you, brother?
But wait, before we get there, if you enter Cooking Issues HRN at the checkout, we'll give you $25 off.
Holy crap! $25 off? It is. Yeah, and there's going to be plenty of food and drink here, right?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, like a lot, right?
Plenty. Yeah, the VIP, you get a little private tour of the chocolate factory in the neighborhood. There'll be some special cocktails that won't be available at the party just for the VIP. And a whole bunch of other surprises. So,
and by that, what we mean is special means Nastasha won't scowl at you when she gives it to you.
That's right. She'll smile at you.
Yeah, yeah. And then you can have both experiences. You can come during the VIP section and get the smile, and then come back during the regular section and get scowled at, so you can get the double. And that's the only...
Might be a private concert from Joe and his band Big Ups, too, for the VIPs. I'm not sure. That's not confirmed.
Not confirmed, but possible?
Possible.
Possible. And there will be raffle tickets there for $25. The VIP, I think I mentioned, is $250. Now, listen. Listen. I don't know whether you notice, whether you listen, but I believe that every time we say it, we say heritageradio.org. And what that means is that we are a nonprofit here at Heritage Radio, which means we need some money to keep this going. We need to make sure that we have people in the engineering booth making this stuff happen. This stuff ain't free, people. Jack, am I right about this?
It's not free. I wish it was free.
It's not free. And, you know, we have, you know, sponsors. But listen, the sponsors we take are sponsors that we believe in. And, you know, it's not – we're not a commercial thing here where anyone can come and just, you know, plunk down money. It's just not the way it operates. This is like we operate more like PBS. We take kind of good people's money when they want to give it to us, and then we rely on you guys for the rest. Is this true or is this false?
You're nailing it.
Yeah. Okay, so listen, please sign up. Come to the party. I'll try to get Nastasha to even smile at the non-VIPs, but, you know, no guarantees.
You know, if somebody buys a ticket now, Joe might be able to get lunch today.
Oh, man.
I'm just kidding. Joe gets lunch.
Yeah, but it's going to be a good lunch if he gets a ticket now.
That's right.
If I had a ticket, it'd be a good lunch. Yeah, okay. Now, yeah, otherwise, you feed him out of what? The scraps bins here at Roberta's? Like when people leave a slice of pizza, like that's what you guys get?
Yeah, exactly. Scraps. Snacky Tunes scraps. That's what we eat.
Yeah, you going to help these guys or what, people? Please. All right. Speaking of... Joel Gargano writes in with a big shout out to Joe and Big Ups. Effing awesome is what he said. He is actually interested in starting another band with you and doing the old mosh pit, the old bringing mosh pits back. Do they still have mosh pits nowadays?
Yes, they do. We have some mosh pits. But I think you're supposed to be in this band too, Dave.
Oh, really?
I think he wants you in it too.
Oh, all right. I mean, are mosh pits, like what level of mosh pit are they now? Are the frat boys still there actually trying to knock people over, or is it more like it used to be?
Well, it depends on, you know, where you're performing. But, you know, sometimes you get some people that are just, you know, going to kick the crap out of me and get kind of scared.
Yeah, but there's kick the crap out of. Yeah, there's kick the crap out of, and then there's kick the crap out of. You know what I mean?
Right. There's like the fun get the crap kicked out of you.
Yeah, like if you take a
yeah,
if you take like a Doc Martin to the face because someone's flying over your head, like that's all in good fun as far as I'm concerned.
But if there's like some guy who's just like you know, red in the face and steam coming out of his ears, and he just looks at you and just stares you down, and he's, you know, this guy's just coming after you.
Yeah, D-bags. They ruin it for everyone.
Exactly. And then I just go hide in the bathroom.
Yeah, that's weak. That's weak sauce. Listen, do they still do crowd surfing in the mosh pits these days?
Oh, definitely.
It's good to see some things haven't changed.
I know. Exactly.
Yeah. All right. So now, another question in from Joel. What's the best way to get coffee flavor into beer? We want to use a local roaster's beans and not buy a pre-made extract. My brother just began operations as a brewer here in Connecticut, Thimble Island Brewing. I'd like to try their product. Maybe someone could send us some Thimble Island Brewing product, right? Try it. It's only in Connecticut, very close to us. And we are doing a number of tests to see the best way to infuse coffee into a stout and hold off the overly bitter/acidic flavors. I'm thinking cold extraction is best suited. You're correct. I went through the infusion post on the Cooking Issues blog and got some good ideas, yet nothing has proven to be tasty on its own. Here's what I did for testing before I attempt to get the coffee flavor into beer. Made an extract in room temperature water at 100 to one. I can't really understand this thing, but 250 grams of coarse ground coffee, medium roast, and did like 3-minute, 1-minute infusions in the ISI whipper with charges, and then blah 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 blah. Anyway, your numbers here are way too not long. Way too not long. What's the right word for that? Way too short. Short is the word I'm looking for. Nastasha actually helped me with that. She gave me this look, and I was like, oh, yeah, short. But when people are doing cold brew in the ISI, they're doing it usually for a much, much longer period of time. When I do it for 2 minutes, 3 minutes, because I'm using alcohol and not water, right? So you could actually do a straight infusion into alcohol, or you could take much longer and infuse it into water. And you had this question right here, like, should I change the liquid medium? Yes. Should we toss the whole beans into the fermenter and hope for the best? No, I would not do that. What I would do is, look, your beers, I don't know what your beers are coming in at, but if they, let's say they're coming in at like 5-6% alcohol, somewhere in there, 7%, 8, whatever. I'm usually extracting into 20% alcohol, 40% alcohol. So my infusions with coffee are very strong, and they happen very quickly, even at room temperature under an ISI infusion regime. I know people that have done cold infusion of coffee into water and liquor in huge by my standards 5 gallon containers like corny kegs, but they're letting it sit a lot longer. With your low alcohol percentage, you are going to have to go a lot longer. Now, I mean, you give it a shot, but my problem with it, if you make super concentrated extracts, is they tend to go bitter. If you're allowed to use an alcohol-based extract, then you could do an alcohol-based coffee extract and dope it in afterwards, right? Just use ISI with high proof, and that's going to be, because if you're actually going to do this in a commercial fashion, you're going to have a difficult time, infusing the entire amount of each batch of coffee that you make. Now, you also say I grabbed a Starbucks Via packet, which is their like supposedly high grade version of freeze dried coffee. I've never tried it, and poured some into a Guinness. It tasted pretty good. Is that a better route? I know Wiley uses that stuff in sauces and whatnot. I don't know whether he does or not. Actually, I haven't talked to him about it. That's interesting. If so, how can I make it myself? That stuff's just freeze dried coffee. And then you ask lastly, what about this guy? And you know, obviously the readers can't, yeah, viewers can't, whatever they are, can't. See it, but it filtered the beer through a bunch of beans before kegging or bottling, and you post a link to the Randall. So what a Randall is a Randall in beer parlance is almost a modified water filter that was developed by the Dogfish Head Brewery people to do post infusion. They developed it for hops, and what you're doing is running the beer out of the keg through a container full of hops that infuses on its way out to the tap. Now, the issue with it, and people have done a lot of coffee in it to add coffee flavors to it, you have to use whole beans with something like that because ground beans are going to cause wicked foaming, wicked foaming. So you need to use whole beans in that. And I don't know how much beer you can filter through it and get the same taste, how long it needs to sit, et cetera, et cetera. So I haven't run any tests with it, but there's plenty of people doing it. There's lots of links out there on how to build a Randall with parts that you know you can buy in a regular hardware store along with things you could buy at a homebrew shop. And what they all amount to is modifying water filters so that you can run the beer through the water filter on the way out to the tap. Now, the Dogfish Head guys realize that foaming is a big problem because, foaming is going to be a big problem when you do that. And so their new version, which is on their website, and you can see it, and they tell you the parts you need to build it, but I don't think they build it for you, has the initial infusion chamber and then a secondary chamber with ice surrounding it to keep the temperature down. That's an anti-foam chamber. So that's an interesting thing. Go look at Randall, and it's named after Randall the enamel eating whatever, blah, 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 because the first thing had so much hops in it when they put it through it that they said it ate the enamel off of your teeth, and those guys at Dogfish Head have to come up with crazy names for everything. They just can't help themselves. They can't help it. So go look that up and try making some extracts with higher proof ethanol or doing it a lot longer with water, or you could do that a lot longer with water in 5 gallon batches, like hours or maybe, you know, hours and hours or maybe overnight, or do traditional grind and then like Kyoto style cold brewing. Anyways, let's take one more commercial break and we'll come back with cooking issues.
I broke my own heart today. My tears blocked from streaming. scarred face. And ooh, they say the heart is proud. And ooh, to mend a broken heart and a broken curse.
Hello, this is Mark Ladner from Del Posto, and you're listening to Heritage Radio Network.
Hell yeah! Yeah, Mark Ladner calling it out. What do you think there, Stas? Did you know that he...
he wasn't even listening.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, he did a shout-out for...
Save me. Hello, this is Mark Ladner from Del Posto, and you're listening to Heritage Radio Network.
Mark Ladner, that's, by the way, like, that's like, if you ever ask Nastasha a question, like, her, like, the only honest answer she can ever give you, I wasn't listening. Yeah, right? All right. So a question from before we missed from Andrew Marcus on gummy candies. Hey, gang. I've recently been trying to make gummy candies at home, but running into some issues, so I thought I'd just defer to you before spending more money on other ingredients that might just lead to more dead ends. Ideally, I'd rather not use gelatin for my veggie friends and potentially not have to cook it so much to preserve the delicate flavors. Nothing specific yet, in other words, on the delicacy of the flavors, just a preference. After reading around, it looks like the only way to achieve the first half, i.e. vegetarian, is with cornstarch or pectin, which both seem to require tons of sugar and require lots of heat. But maybe I'm way off. I was working with Gelan, low acyl and high acyl Gelan previously, but haven't been able to get anything nearly chewy enough with good elasticity and shear. Do you have any advice? Usage rates for those hydrocolloids would be awesome too. Oh, if I can make it even more complicated, is there any way to add alcohol to the recipe, or would that increase the liquid portion too much and make the gel too loose? Thanks for any help you can give, Andrew Marcus. Okay. You're not going to have any actual alcoholic candy that's gummy, because by the time you get the solids level high enough, you're not going to have much alcohol left in it at all. You can make things that are hard like rocks, really jelly, gelled, that have, bless you.
Thank you.
That have fairly high alcohol. The limit with most hydrocolloids in higher concentrations to get good gel strength is about 20% alcohol in the finished thing. I've done with some hydrocolloids higher, like I've done fluid gel, agar fluid gels at like 25, 28%, then have gotten them to work, alcohol, especially if the you have to add the alcohol later with agar, because alcohol can't be boiled at agar setting temperatures to, well, brain's gone today. The temperatures that you require to get the agar functional. Hydrate. There we go. The alcohol will boil off before those temperatures happen. So most things that are, so you can do like a fluid gel that's pretty high in alcohol using agar or any one of those things, and you can set gels with them with a high enough, if you add a high enough, not too high in alcohol. My brain is so fried today. Crazy. Anyways. So, but you're not going to get something that's a gummy candy that has actual appreciable amounts of alcohol in it, although it can have the flavor, the base flavor of an alcohol just by adding it and boiling off all of the water and alcohol in it. Okay, so that's that part of the question. Also, low acyl and high acyl Gelan mixes, you're not going to be able to get you can get very good gelatin replacement with high acyl and low acyl Gelan in the ratios that are normal for gelatin, but in the super high ratio that's in a gummy candy of gelatin in there, it's not going to have the same texture there that gelatin will. So I don't think you're going to be barking up the right tree with that. I've looked into other hydrocolloid replacers to do gelatin replacement, and the one most people use seems to be agar. Agar also, I mean, having done high percentage agar gummies before, there's not going to get the right amount. There's not going to get the right texture with that. You might be able to. I haven't looked it up. I wasn't able to check it out, but there are Kappa carrageenan and locust bean gum mixes, and you can actually use agar and locust bean gum, but it's not quite the same. But and go to CP Kelco and look up their gelatin replacers, or call them, CP Kelco, and they might have a Kappa carrageenan / locust bean gum, and the Kappa is providing the gelling, and the locust bean gum is getting it to act more like gelatin, make it softer. They might have a mix that can be used in a high enough ratio to allow it to do gummy candies, but I don't know, and I doubt it's ever going to have the stretch and pull of a gummy bear. I mean, you might get something similar. Now, the real awesome one is, as you say, pectin, but you do have to cook the crap out of pectin to get it to work. What you could do is cook the bulk of it and overcook it slightly, and then add super concentrated fresh flavors back. And Nastasha and I did that years ago with we rotovapped strawberry, fresh strawberry juice down to like a high brick syrup, overcooked pectin and sugar, and then mixed it in. We never achieved hard thing. We achieved like a toffee, yeah. But it was the most delicious toffee I've ever had in my life. I wish I had that right now. It's so delicious. It was just really hard for us to calculate exactly what the bricks was, because what you're doing when you're boiling is taking it to a certain temperature, but what you're really shooting for is a certain liquid content. And pectin requires high acidity and a high solids content, and that's why you have to cook it. You don't want to cook it. You can't cook it quickly, because if you cook it quickly, you're going to scorch the fruit at the bottom, which is the problem why everything has to be done slowly and more mellowly. But you know, maybe you could get away with adding a little bit, you know, after the fact, after it's been cooked up to temperature, as long as you get the ratios right. So sorry I couldn't be super helpful, but there you have it. Okay, and I'm gonna have to rock through these, or Jack's gonna pull my microphone out, because it's just the kind of guy he is. Remember, we don't have enough money to keep my microphone plugged in. I'm just kidding. They have another show coming on, is actually what the story is. Okay, have a question in from is this from Paul? In one of the Cooking Issues radio episodes, Dave mentioned that he uses a particular sharpening stone. It's proving impossible to find the name by going back through all the episodes. Would it be possible to email me the name? I think it was three initials or an acronym or three initials. Well, better than that, here it is in the real life. DMT. I use Duo Sharp DMT diamond whetstones. When you're buying a whetstone, none of the real hardcore knife people use this, and they're going to say I'm a bad human being for using it, but when I actually sharpen, everyone's like, man, it's pretty freaking sharp. It's pretty freaking sharp. You want to get the largest stone you can possibly get, because that's going to make sharpening large stones easy. The one I have, one of the reasons why a lot of knife aficionados hate it is because it's got an interrupted pattern in it, and that makes for easier clearing and less kind of gumming up with the abrasive as you're working, but like real hardcore people don't like it. I like it fine. What I like about this one is it stays flat forever. It's very thin. It's not very heavy. It's unbreakable, unwarpable, and doesn't need to be dressed. So I get the 10-inch Duo Sharp. I buy it in fine. The one I get is fine/extra fine, which is 25 micron grit on the fine side and 9 micron grit on the other. I think I've also said before, and if you're a freaking psycho and you like super high, polishing stuff out, DMT now makes an 8-inch stone, unfortunately not a 10, that is like a straight diamond with no interrupted holes, that has a super extra fine 3-micron grit, which is like insanely small. That's as small as most of the high-end Japanese stuff, and that'll take it to a polish. But as I've said many times before, Japanese grits and American grits don't correlate with each other, the Japanese grit numbers being higher for the equivalent thing than an American grit number. And secondly, an actual grit number isn't necessarily going to indicate everything. It indicates a certain particle size, but not a spread and distribution of particle sizes, nor how they are bound to the substrate. So there's a lot to be known. And what I really recommend you all do, if you're interested in abrasives, is go to the Unified Abrasives Manufacturer Association, UAMA.org, and go to their section called Abrasive Grains 101, and they have a great little web thingamajig on kind of what is actually going on, like what the grains look like, what the different materials are, why you would use different materials, and what that means. But if you just want the simple answer, go get a DMT 10-inch Duo Sharp green/red. Yeah? Yeah. Okay. And we got one last thingamajiggy in from Chris, who says, and he just calls you out. He just says, hey, Nastasha. He doesn't give a crap about the rest of us. Right. Does not care. Anyway.
He knows where his bread is buttered.
Yeah, right. Ruhlmann and Poulsen just released their latest on salumi. And in fact, I just got it. I just got the new salumi book. Is it actually out yet or not? Do you know?
Don't know.
Yeah, anyway, I have it. I have it, you know, because I got it. Anyway, Ruhlmann and Poulsen just released their latest on salumi and go into some fair detail on whole pig butchery, curing, etc. Where it comes up a little short is on specifics for curing chambers. How much airflow do you need? Mechanisms for controlling humidity? Minimum practical sizes, etc. Do you guys have a good reference for someone trying to set up a small/trial-and-development scale chamber? I want to give some copa and lard a shot, before committing to a larger setup for the shop. So is it going to have to live in an apartment until I can convince the boss that it's ready for prime time. Also, in what may be a long shot, the website for National Center for Home Food Preservation publication seems to have been shut down. Any chance you or Dave has a copy of their curedmeats.pdf referenced in the November 15th, 2011 radio show, I think, or know a place to grab it? Okay, so I went on the National Center for Home Curing and Food Preservation, and I didn't get to go back to listen to what I said, but most of their publications are back up, so I don't know if you had a temporary problem, whether it was temporarily broken and now it's back, but if it's still down, I'll look for the specific one that you need to find. Some of them are organized in a wonky way, like you have to click next, next, next to get through it, and you can't download it easily, but it seems to be there. Now, back to Ruhlmann Poulsen. One of the great things I saw about it is they actually, very early in the book, said something that people need to say more often. They said, when you're making salumi in America, do not try to make Italian salumi in America. Make American salumi. And I think that's a great, great thing. So, for instance, Sam Edwards, our good friend and one of the benefactors of the Heritage Radio, he sells his hams as Suriano, trying to piggyback on Serrano-style hams, which I think is a mistake. And I've told him this to his face. This is nothing he doesn't like already know that I think is a mistake, because I think American hams are amazing, delicious, and they're their own product. They shouldn't be compared to Spanish hams. They shouldn't be compared to Italian hams. They're American products. And the same goes with, if you're making salumi here, don't try to make an Italian product. Make an American. I mean, you can use Italian techniques, but you should be shooting. If you're trying to shoot to make somebody else's product, then all you're ever going to be is a runner-up to their product. If you try to make your own product, then you get to be the best at that, and you can focus on what makes it better, what makes it worse, which isn't to say you don't respect and love the procedures, techniques, and flavors that someone uses in a place like Italy. But I'll tell you what Fong told us. From what's the Imperial Tea Court, right, is the name of his place, Stas, that we went out and visited. He's growing tea in California now, and I asked him, I was like, what do you want the tea to taste like? He said was probably the most profound thing he could say about this. He says, I want it to taste like California wants tea to taste. In other words, he wants to make tea that tastes like what tea should taste like when it's grown to the best of its abilities in California. Anyway, so I thought it was a good point that Ruhlmann and Poulsen brought up in that. But then let's go on to your actual question. If you want to see what real badass curing technology is like, before I get into your actual answer, see how long it takes me to get into an actual answer? It's ridiculous. Nastasha's shaking her head and giving me her I hate you face. Okay. The Italian company Travaglini, which is, you know, spelled Travaglini, right, are the world's greatest curing, drying, aging, and like ham and salumi production equipment machine people in the world. They are the best, bar none. They are amazing. In fact, they're the company I always point at when I say that technology can be used for good in the production of food rather than just for making it cheaper, because these guys have developed curing rooms and aging rooms that are specifically designed to mimic what goes on. They originally built it around what goes on in Parma, like in a Parma ham. So they get humidity, they get temperature, they cycle the humidity and the temperature inside the place to mimic the day-night, day-in-out changes and seasonal changes in the ham. Because that's what's driving the aging in a long-cured process like ham, is not just the humidity and the temperature, but the shift in humidity and temperature from both season to season and through day-night. Okay, so look at their stuff if you want to see some real badassery. Okay, now, you're exactly correct. In the book, I looked, and they all do have that's a paltry kind of amount of information on how to make a curing thing. Remember this. The smaller a curing chamber is, the less stable it's going to be over time. People really, and they do mention this a lot, which is probably why they don't really go into it too much, people love their curing rooms. Going back to Sam Edwards, who I talked about before, he has a number of curing houses for his hams, and he says he can know which one. You could blindfold him, bring him into one, and he'll know which one it is based on smell, because curing houses develop their own set of microflora and fauna, I guess, over time, and those are going to influence the flavor of each one of the products. So it's incredibly important. So you're not going to get probably a stability of flavor in a small thing, because it's too easy to push a small item one way or the other. Same way it's hard to get a small fish tank to stay in good shape forever, because if it goes a little bit off, it goes way off, whereas larger fish tanks can be more self-corrective because they're larger systems. That said, if you want to basically just look, you don't want, you said airflow. I don't have a lot of data right now on airflow, but you need You don't want too much airflow because it's going to cause case hardening on the outside, drying off, but you know, some might be there. But for the best deal in control of a small setup, and by that I mean you're going to convert a fridge to an aging chamber, or you're going to convert, you know, I don't know, some sort of like a small box, that I could not believe what a cheap deal it is. And they're going to be back in stock, they say, in September, on September 20th. Go to Auber Instruments. I've used one of their things. It's fine. It's okay. They're the cheapest people in the world, Auber Instruments. And check this out. For $97, they have a plug-and-play temperature and humidity controller that already has the sensor on it. So what you do is you just plug in a humidifier or a dehumidifier and a heating element into it, and they handle up to 10 amps, and put it in and just dial in what you want it to be. Right? So there's two ways you can do this. If you know that your chamber is always going to have too low of a humidity, then you could attach a humidifier to it and jack the humidity into it. If you know that the humidity is always going to be too, it's going to be too humid, then you can add a dehumidifier to it. So another way you could do it, for instance, you can set the humidity of a chamber by doing something like if you go to Google saturated salt solution, RH, standing for relative humidity. So sodium, NaCl, so, you know, sodium chloride, table salt, saturated solution. If you have a saturated solution that's sitting in your chamber, the chamber is going to equilibrate to 75% humidity. So if you want lower than that, then you could put a dehumidifier on that sucker, and you know that you're always going to need to dehumidify it slightly to get it down to 60 or 70% humidity when you're going. If you know, if the other way to do it is, if you know that you're always in a relatively non-humid environment, you could put a fan which moves a little bit of air out of it to keep the humidity down, and then put a humidifier attached to it that makes it humid as it goes. So that's the way I would go about doing it, and it's cheap and it should work. We'll see you when you get back, when I get back from Columbia Cooking Issues.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Just can't get it straight. Vicious, vicious vodka.